Before I begin today, does anyone have any questions about anything they want to bring up? This lecture today is important in the context of the class as a whole because this is the kind of conclusion of the story that we've been trying to sort out in the whole second part of the class, the whole story of the Cold War. Remember how this whole analysis is structured? We look at all these different occasions at which it seemed that a settlement was in reach. A settlement of what? Of the central problem that lay at the heart of the Cold War. What was that problem? The German question. Why was the German question of such fundamental importance? Because it was the only major exception to the fundamental rule about how the two sides could get along with each other in Europe. Each side would control things on its side of the line of demarcation in Europe. But there was one exception to that rule. The Soviets could not give the Western powers a totally free hand to do whatever they wanted in Germany, because if Germany became too independent, too strong, that would pose a very fundamental threat to the USSR's most basic interests in Europe. They had to head it off before things got totally out of hand. Right? So the question was, would German power be contained? Would German power be contained within a structure dominated by the United States? And there were important factors, a lot of them having to do with the USSR, which pushed the West toward a strategy of building up Germany, transforming Germany's political status, making Germany much more of a part, or much more of an integral part of the Western world. All these things were sources of concern for the Soviets, right? So how could you solve it? And we looked at these different points in the story when it seemed like an understanding was within reach. The understanding between Burns and Stalin at Potsdam. The formal, in 1945, the formal division of Europe symbolized by the ending of the Berlin blockade, the establishment of the two German states, the establishment of a formal security structure, namely the North Atlantic Treaty, also in the spring of 1949, and we tried to understand why that too didn't work, why that too was followed the very next year, 1950, by a very deep, very scary crisis. And then we looked at how things evolved in the early 1950s and how the West, thanks to the buildup of American power that began in late 1950, now had a free hand to construct its own system, which it did. This is the system embodied in the Paris Accords. This was not imposed on Europe by the Americans. Quite the contrary. The Americans didn't like this at all. Eisenhower had his heart set on the European defense community, getting the Europeans to come together so that they could balance Soviet power on their own and we could pull back. Right? But the Americans went along with the Paris Accord system very grudgingly. And that largely explains why the Paris Accord system, which provided for significant restraints on German power, especially in the nuclear area, but by no means limited to that, why the system embodied in the Paris Accords didn't work. And the key thing here is the Eisenhower nuclear sharing policy, that the American government wanted the Europeans, including the Germans, to have effective control over nuclear weapons. Fundamental Soviet concern. Very raw Soviet nerve. The Berlin crisis that began in 1958, that was a product of that concern. The fact that you had this Berlin crisis beginning in 1958, during a period of still quite dramatic Soviet strategic inferiority, is a measure of the fact that a political understanding had not been worked out, that the system based on the Paris Accords was not something that turned out to be viable. The Paris Accords did not lay the basis for a system that both sides could live with, because the Americans had not had their heart in it. And now we come to the Kennedy period. Very important, very major shift of policy from Eisenhower to Kennedy on these European issues. You know, Eisenhower wants to get out. Kennedy thinks that's not possible. Kennedy thinks as long as we're stuck, we have to call the shots. Very different from the Eisenhower policy of, you know, negotiating with the Europeans, trying to kind of shepherd these different countries together so that they could pursue a common policy. Right? And in particular, on the whole issue of nuclear sharing and a German finger on the nuclear trigger. Eisenhower, this didn't bother him. Eisenhower was, in a sense, quite a realist. Germany was a country like anyone else. You know, Germany had been a problem in the past, but that was because Russia was weak. Now that Russia's strong, he says, I'll take a strong Germany. No problem for and a strong Germany, of course, means a nuclear-armed Germany. Kennedy, out of the question that Germany should have nuclear weapons. Right? But if Germany is nuclear, Germany can't defend herself against the Soviet Union. The Americans have to stay in. But if the Americans are going to be in, the Americans should call the shots, because we don't want to just stand by and allow matters to drift to the point where a war was possible and our own cities were the targets of nuclear attack. Okay, so you have a very active policy. So that shift in policy from Eisenhower to Kennedy is what makes a political settlement within reach. The Americans are now willing to give the Soviets what they most desire in Europe. This is made clear to the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, when he and Kennedy meet in Vienna in June of 61. And Kennedy says these things which were so important that they were sanitized out of the record that was released to the American people like 30 years later, the initial declassification of those documents. And the goal was to keep it from the American people, because the Soviets obviously knew what Kennedy had told them. What were those two things that were sanitized out? Number one, We understand your concerns about Germany, and the implications very clear. We will, as part of a settlement, do whatever we have to do to keep Germany from getting nuclear weapons, West Germany, that is. And the other thing was, we recognize the fact that the Soviet Union has special interests in Eastern Europe. In other words, again, a lot of this is decoding diplomatic language, but it's we accept Eastern Europe as a Soviet sphere of influence. We're not going to go to war to prevent it. You know, this was an element in American policy that goes way back to Roosevelt and even more to Burns. Kennedy makes this explicit. So you may say, well, that should have been it. That should have been the settlement. The Soviets should have said, well, let's wrap things up. You know, let's draft the paper and I'll sign on the dotted line. But it doesn't happen that way. So in a sense, this is a bit of a puzzle, because it shows how second order dynamics can come into play to screw everything up. See, it doesn't happen that way. And it's only after the crisis develops and comes to a head with the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962, that following that, the elements of a settlement, a near settlement, comes into being. The elements of a settlement gradually emerge in the course of international political relations in the year 1963, very important year in the history of the Cold War. This is the great watershed between the Cold War is a sharp international conflict, the sort of thing that could have led to a third world war, indeed to a general thermonuclear war. And then post 63, all of that fades. No one thinks in these apocalyptic terms anymore. The Cold War is transformed, in a sense, into a political system, a set of understandings that provide the basis for on which these countries can relate to each other without having to run the risk of war. Okay? Why did the new American policy not lead directly to a set of understandings with the Soviets that would have stabilized the international system the way Kennedy wanted? Well, they were viewed as evidence of American weakness. The Americans were now so scared of nuclear war that we were bending over backwards to do whatever we had to do to avoid allowing matters to take that course. All these things that the Americans were telling the Soviets, we're going to move toward accepting the status quo, not just in Europe generally, but in Germany in particular, toward de facto recognition of the East German regime, toward arrangements that would make sure that West Germany didn't have her finger on the nuclear trigger. All these things, these are things you really want, they are in your interest. Well, that was evidence of American weakness, American fears. Americans weren't willing to risk war. And the Soviets could exploit that fact. Khrushchev was a big admirer of, can you guess which American statesman? John Foster Dulles, Eisenhower's Secretary of State. The man who talked about brinkmanship, how you need to go to the brink of nuclear war in order to get what you want politically. And both in public and in private in those days, Khrushchev often expressed his admiration for Dulles. And this was a strategy that he could emulate. Of course, there was no real risk of war, because you could always pull back. But if you threaten the other side with war, they're going to give way. And then you know who admired Khrushchev among American statesmen of the Cold War period? Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon, he thought Khrushchev was the most brilliant statesman he had ever seen. For precisely that reason. And he tried to do that same sort of thing when he was president. Right? And it's not that it's absurd. It's not that strategies of that sort never work, because they do work. You can, make gains by exploiting the other side's fears. But they corrupt the system. Well, that's a bit of a digression. So there is no settlement in 1961, and instead matters go from bad to worse. The Soviets look at this shift in American policy, interpret these things as concessions, interpret them as a reflection of America's fear of war. And by the way, they were not the only ones to interpret in those terms. The Europeans, especially the French government, also interpreted in those terms. And so there was no settlement in late 61 or early 62. And as a result of that, U.S. policy hardens. It's like, what's the matter with these people? We're willing to give them everything that they have a legitimate right to, maybe even a little tiny bit more besides that. But they have to respect us too, and they're not. We're as strong as they are. They can't expect us to be totally craven, to just walk away from our most solemn commitments in Berlin. Our whole political position in Europe will collapse. And then the whole world balance of power will shift against us. We gotta, in the final analysis, if they're not going to respond when we're being this reasonable, we have to ultimately, steel ourselves and face the inevitability of a confrontation with them. So you look at the documents, it's very clear in the course of the year 1962 that this American attitudes are hardened. The Americans come to think that a showdown with the Soviets is inevitable because they're just so impossible. They're out to humiliate us. We can't accept that. That means a confrontation is unavoidable. And then, and here's the really important point, because one of the things we're interested in this class is the connection between the strategic balance and actual policy. And everyone should know the basic outline of how the strategic balance changed over time. Remember the little chart I had in the back on the board when I was talking about MC-48 and stuff, and how America's strategic superiority peaked around 1953-54. Then there's this kind of long, slow decline until. Finally, in September of 1963, Kennedy is briefed by the agency of the government whose job it was to evaluate these things. It was called the Net Evaluation Subcommittee of the National Security Council. In September of 1963, Kennedy is told, that's it. We no longer have the upper hand. Right? No matter how fast we move, no matter how hard we strike, the other side will have enough left in terms of both weapons and delivery systems to retaliate against us and destroy America as a functioning society. You know, that's something we cannot contemplate, a nuclear first strike in those circumstances. We had entered into the world of nuclear parity. We had lost our strategic edge. No longer American superiority. September of 1962, America still has an upper hand. We can contemplate going first in the event of a war if our back is toward the wall. All right? But we know it's going to end in the near future. This was one of the reasons why, in 1961, Kennedy was so eager to settle the whole Berlin crisis. Better we should negotiate when we still have the upper hand strategically than to wait for a couple of years until it's a world of nuclear parity and we no longer have that edge. Right? But now, in 1962, the argument cuts in the opposite direction. If a negotiated settlement is not in the cards, if the other side is so intransigent that they're out to humiliate us, and that's something we can't accept, then we have to face the inevitability of a military confrontation with them, of the crisis coming to a head. That being the case, we want it to happen sooner rather than later. We want it to happen while we still have our nuclear edge and not after we lose it. Kennedy was quite explicit about this in September of 1962, right before the missiles were discovered in Cuba. And there's no question that the policy the United States pursued during the Cuban Missile Crisis was worked out with those considerations in mind. Okay, I'm not going to talk about the missile crisis in any great detail, although it's quite interesting. But what's important to note about the missile crisis is the Americans decide to insist that the Soviets withdraw those missiles from Cuba, knowing that this is going to lead to a big crisis, and that the Soviets, in the final analysis, have no interest whatsoever in an armed clash with the United States. The Khrushchev policy had been basically a bluff. The Soviets give way to the American threat that the United States was about to invade Cuba. Right? It's not a capitulation, pure and simple, because this American ultimatum is softened in various ways, in two ways in particular. We sugarcoat the what is a very bitter pill for the Soviets by giving them two things. One is we agree to withdraw our land-based intermediate-range ballistic missiles from Turkey and from Italy, weapons which threaten the Soviets. and if they withdrew their missiles from Cuba. And also we kind of promised that we wouldn't invade the island of Cuba, although that was subject to arrangements about inspection and so on that Castro was unwilling to live with. So technically the United States never made a formal promise to not invade Cuba. But still, you know, this was softening the terms for the Soviets. Although all this stuff was done in secret. The Soviets have said, you better keep this secret, because if you breathe the word of this in public, you know, the deal's off. We won't be bound at all. And they kept their side of the bargain. Right? Cuban Missile Crisis, it's very important in this story. It tells us something about crises in general and how we should think about them. The normal tendency is to think of crises as, you know, introducing, you know, a real danger into the situation. They kind of come out of nowhere, a crisis develops, people get very scared, it seems like, you know, we're on the verge of a war, and then they kind of go away. They're just these kind of isolated events. And that's very different from the view that I want you to take in this course, which is that crises aren't to be ripped out of historical context in that way. They play an important part in the story. They're an integral part of the story. They make sense only in the context of the larger story. In this case, Cuban Missile Crisis makes sense only in the context of this whole Berlin affair. It's the climactic event of the Berlin crisis. Okay. Again, why is this important? Crises are more than an indication of a basic instability in the system. They also play a role which can be stabilizing. Why is this? Did I mention to you about Jeffrey Blaney's book about the origins of war? Blaney was he was an Australian, and he was interested in coming up with some general sense for what makes for war. And his whole argument was, you wouldn't have war if everyone saw things the same way, if everyone understood the strategic balance the same way, everyone understood what everyone's interests were the same way, and so on. It's only because people view these things differently that you have war. Each side thinks it's going to win. Right? And wars actually played a function in this story, because wars reveal what the true military balance is. And since they reveal the true military balance, who is more powerful than the other, that new information determines for both sides what sort of political relationship they'll have. You know, wars play the role of clarifying things and thus can lead to a stable system. Okay, crises play the same role. You can extend this whole idea to look at crises. Crises provide information. Problems emerge from the lack of information, but that is, information is revealed by events. In this case, the Cuban Missile Crisis reveals that the Soviets are not 10 feet tall, they're not made out of steel, that the Americans are not craven. It reveals that the Khrushchev policy had been a bit of a bluff. The Soviets, after all, had capitulated to an American ultimatum. No matter how you sugarcoat that, those facts, that was the core reality. And having revealed something fundamental, it therefore paves the way to perhaps an improvement in political relations. You see this a lot in international politics. For example, the Fashoda crisis, 1898, between Britain and France, it paves the way to the Anglo-French Entente just 6 years later. Cuban Missile Crisis, how did it affect policy? It did not lead to a change in American policy. Kennedy continues with his stabilization policy. This whole idea that we got to reach an understanding with the other side, so that both sides can agree on a set of arrangements that safeguard everyone's core political interests. Each side relates to the other on a business-like basis. If we're effectively moving into a world of nuclear parity, the political relationship that emerges should reflect that. It should basically be based on the status quo. They can't hope to push us out of Western Europe. We can't hope to push them out of Eastern Europe. Both sides should live with the status quo because they have approximately equal power. You know, and that's people think of Kennedy as this ideologue. You know, I think I mentioned this before. He gave this inaugural speech, you know, we will pay any price, we will bear any burden. You know, people think, oh, isn't this wonderful? Isn't this wonderful rhetoric, soaring, challenging rhetoric and so on? That's not the real Kennedy at all. That's his speechwriters. You know, that's his pandering to the public that has a certain ideology. You know, it's like you have to understand a certain element of deception and dishonesty is built into the basic structure of the whole system of international politics, because political leaders have to live in two worlds. They live in the world of international politics, where power political considerations are preeminent, and also the world of domestic politics, in which they have to cater to, pander to, the ideological preferences of the people to whom they're politically responsible at home. And so, naturally, there's going to be a gap. And the only way of papering over that gap is to tell the people one thing and actually pursue policy of a very different sort. You know, in other words, through deception. That's why secrecy is so important in international political life. And that was certainly the case with Kennedy. He didn't believe in any of this soaring ideological rhetoric that he was mouthing. He was a power politician, pure and simple. You know, very practical-minded. He's a professional politician. You know, he thought in terms of power. He's contemptuous of ideological approaches. We got to relate. The two big powers have to relate to each other on a business-like basis. Here are the terms of the settlement. This is what I think is necessary. This is what we're gonna do. Okay, and on the other side, the Soviet side, there was a dramatic transformation in their tactics. The Khrushchev policy threatening the West, this is all discredited. It's all bankrupt. Khrushchev pays for this huge failure with his political career. He's forced out by his colleagues in the Politburo in 1964, mainly because of his reckless foreign policy that had done so much to tarnish the Soviet image for responsible statecraft. What's very interesting here about this story is, just as America is losing a nuclear edge, it's then and only then that a stable system takes shape. How is that possible? You think it would be exactly the opposite. You think that now that the Soviets are equal to America in terms of strategic power, they could pursue a more adventuristic policy, you know, tougher policy. You know, if military considerations were the only things that mattered, America's ability to deter a Soviet attack on Europe, to protect Western Europe, would become increasingly threadbare, and that should be a source of empowerment for the Soviets. But instead of that, you move from the policies of the Khrushchev era to the policies of his successors, which were very moderate. Just look toward the maintenance of the status quo in Europe. And that shows you that what's important is not what goes on in the military sphere in this case, but rather what was going on in the political sphere. You know, the kinds of understandings that were reached on the, that would provide a basis for how the two sides could live with each other. Okay. How does Kennedy propose to proceed? Not so much directly, by trying to work out a treaty or something, some sort of formal agreement that would provide for Soviet acceptance of the status quo in Berlin and our agreement to kind of keep West Germany non-nuclear. Neither side wants to do that. What if Soviets don't want to do it? Because it would be too obvious an admission that the policy that they had pursued with regard to Berlin was being abandoned under American pressure and so on. The Americans don't want to do it because anything that formal is bound to irritate the Europeans, and especially the West Germans, that we are cooperating with the Soviets, our common enemy supposedly, to keep West Germany down. Poison in the alliance, that sort of thing. So they don't want to do it in an overt, direct way. They want to do it in an informal, indirect way. So how do you deal with these things? You deal with it by muddying the waters. Instead of talking about keeping nuclear weapons out of the hands of the Germans, we're going to talk about the general importance of limiting the spread of nuclear weapons. Well, the term non-proliferation now comes into common use. Right? Spread of nuclear weapons. This is a bad thing. The whole word proliferation has a very negative connotation. We can deal with these German problems, this problem of a German nuclear force, by looking at it, working out arrangements in that broader context. All of humanity has an interest in limiting the spread of nuclear weapons and so on. All that kind of rhetoric is designed to conceal the fact that you're dealing here with core political issues, namely, how much power is Germany going to have? And Berlin, the whole Berlin business, this is also in the context of general acceptance of the need to stabilize the status quo in Europe and so on. Berlin is just part of that. But they do get involved in these negotiations. And the hope is that once America and Russia reach a fundamental agreement, then you could impose it on your allies. And I'm using words like impose because this is the way they themselves talked about these things. The allies could be made to go along with this. They wouldn't like it, especially the Germans, but we can so arrange things that they have no choice. And it was Kennedy's hope that first you could reach an agreement with the Soviets, and then once you had that, then you could push the Allies into line. But it didn't work out that way. The story here is kind of an interesting story. It didn't work out that way, and in fact, the crisis within the alliance, which had been building up since 1961, came to a head in January of 1963. You recall how Kennedy, when he came to office, he adopted this new NATO strategy based on the idea of centralizing control in the hands of the political authorities in Washington. The Americans would call the shots in terms of political negotiations with the Soviets over Berlin and so on. The Americans would manage the western side of any crisis that developed. They would centralize control over nuclear weapons, not just in American hands, but in the hands of the political authorities in Washington. Sackier's wings were clipped. General Norstat was fired. They had this whole plan for the multilateral force, which was designed to create the mirage that the Europeans were participating in the nuclear defense of Europe. But it was a sham because the use of that force would be subject to an American veto, which would, and Kennedy himself thought, I don't see how the Europeans are getting anything from this over and above what they already have in terms of the American nuclear guarantee. All right, so you have that policy being put in place, and then the Europeans resenting it. Getting the British out of the nuclear business, trying to prevent France from developing a nuclear capability, above all, trying to prevent the Germans from going that route. All this stuff is just poison in the alliance. And this crisis is developing through the years 1961, 62. A lot of people in the American government, especially in military circles, don't like this at all. But Kennedy, in the final analysis in early 62, he's not prepared to overturn the policy, but he's coming to have his doubts about it. And by the end of 1962, he's reached the conclusion that the policy is going to have to be abandoned, but not in a direct way, because you don't want to basically say, well, we screwed up and we adopted this policy that was counterproductive, and now we have to move on to something new. So they use an episode that developed almost by chance to shift course and opt for a totally different policy. This is called the Skybolt Affair. And Skybolt was this air-launched ballistic missile that could attack targets in the Soviet Union, launched from airplanes that were outside the Soviet air defense network. So the effect of Skybolt, which is a weapon we were developing, we had promised to sell to the British once it had been developed, the Skybolt would prolong the life of the British man-based bomber force and give a new lease on life to the British nuclear deterrent. These agreements had been worked out under Eisenhower. Now the Americans reached the conclusion that Skybolt wasn't worth developing, that the weapon had all kinds of technical problems. We had other weapons we were developing that could serve these strategic purposes just as well. So the question was, well, what were you going to give the British to replace Skybolt, if anything? And the natural alternative were the best weapons in the American arsenal. The submarine, above all, the submarine-launched Polaris missile. You couldn't destroy these weapons with a first strike. No one could find submarines, so they were survivable weapons. And so, but a lot of people in the U.S. government didn't want to give the British Polaris. Why? Because whereas Skybolt would only give them a few extra years of an effective deterrent, Polaris would enable them to have a deterrent for an indefinite period, enable them to move from the bomber age into the missile age. And it was inconsistent with this basic philosophy of getting the British out of the nuclear business. Not because anyone was worried about the British and themselves. Because if you continue cooperating with the British, how can you then withhold these weapons from your continental allies? Wouldn't you have to kind of give them to France as well? And if you gave them to France, how can you say no to West Germany? But if you wanted to keep West Germany away from a nuclear capability, therefore you had to say no to the French and no to the British. With this German problem in mind. That was the basic thinking of the State Department. Kennedy wasn't quite ready in the spring of 62 to overturn the policy and irritate all these people in the State Department. But by the end of 62, he had come to the conclusion that that policy was bankrupt, that it was ruining our alliances, that it didn't have any positive effect. And so they used the whole Skybolt business as a chance to kind of put the country on the course of a new NATO policy. We will provide Polaris to the British. All they have to agree is that these submarines will be assigned to NATO, but in an extreme national emergency, they can take them out and use them themselves. Kennedy's idea was that this would provide the basis for negotiations with France, and if France cooperates with us on basic political issues, we'll help France develop this sort of survivable capability and so on. But they'll draw the line. France, yes, Britain, yes, but no to Germany. And, you know, people say, the Germans will never accept this. That sort of discrimination is inconsistent with their loyalty to the alliance. And Kennedy's view was, well, where do they have to go? You know, they'll have no choice. If Britain, France, and the United States say, we're going to draw the line here, we're the charmed circle. And you can't have them. They're not going to like it, but they'll accept it, all right? And on that basis, we can reach this understanding with the Soviets. So that's the Kennedy policy. But it's not an overt policy because they do not want to make it too clear that their previous policy had been no good. They don't want to pay the political price at home. So there's a lot of kicking up of dust and deliberate creation of ambiguity. And this allows the champions of the earlier policy to try and sabotage what Kennedy is doing. I mean, this is a really extraordinary part of this whole story. The leader of that, I guess the term is a clique, the group of people that think that thought that we had to maintain the policy of taking nuclear weapons away from the Europeans, you know, concentrating control over nuclear forces in Washington and so on. He was the Undersecretary of State named George Ball. And these people, they looked at the agreement that was reached about Skybolt as its total disaster. But their tactic was to pretend that it didn't change anything and the American policy was as it had been. So Ball goes over to Europe and he tells the French and the Germans, no change in our policy, we're still, the British aren't going to have independent use, everything is going to be tied to the MLF, and so on and so on. And de Gaulle, the French leader, he's basically, you know, first you tell us that you're going to support our independent nuclear program, and now, you know, you come over and say, no, there's been no change in policy. Just furious. And he rises up against the Americans. January 14th, 1963, gives a very famous press conference, you know, vetoing Britain's admission in the common market. But the real thrust of this policy was directed not against Britain, but against America. Because why do you want to keep Britain out? Because Britain is America's Trojan horse, you know, stuffed with all these nuclear weapons, but incapable of using them independently. If you believe in an independent Europe, that's something more than an American satellite, a Europe with a political personality of its own, you got to keep the British out. You got to stand up to the Americans, right? Kennedy's hope was you could make a deal with the French. It's sabotaged by a key official in his own government. but what makes matters worse is that 8 days after de Gaulle gives this press conference, Adenauer comes over to Paris to sign this very famous Treaty of Friendship with France. He embraces de Gaulle. Basically, it's like not just France, but Western Europe, continental Western Europe as a whole, is standing up against the Americans, rising up against the Americans. You know, it's intolerable from the American point of view. You know, these people are our lives are on the line to protect them. You know, we are going to assert our, quote, leadership. You know, and basically we force Adenauer out. He refers to this as the third time he was forced out of office. His own party, insists that he resign as a chancellor and not serve another term. And the Americans are behind the scenes, you know, prodding all of his opponents within the German political elite. Anyway, this whole story is quite extraordinary. You can't do much about de Gaulle, but the Germans are right there on the front line. They're really subject to American pressure, to American threat of withdrawal, and that threat is in fact made. The line is drawn in the sand for the Germans in early 1963. They back off from the Adenauer policy. They opt for the policy of loyalty to the United States. In this Franco-German treaty, they stick in a preamble unilaterally, you know, proclaiming their loyalty to America. Now, a very serious thing. Kennedy hadn't wanted the crisis within the alliance to come to a head in such a sharp way. He had hoped to kind of finesse all these things so that there wouldn't be all this drama and stuff like that. But the fact was the Germans had been forced to choose, and they chose the U.S. route. And this was ratified, in effect, by the German population, because Kennedy went over to Germany in June of 63, and he makes it clear what his policy is, and the Germans go wild over Kennedy and give him a phenomenally positive reception, so on. This is the famous Ich bin ein Berliner speech that Kennedy gave at that time. So the European business, getting the Allies to toe the line, it was taken care of, not in the best possible way. And but they're going to do what the Americans wanted them to do. And now it's just a question of working things out with the Soviets. And as I say, there are all these negotiations. And these issues of German nuclear weapons, Berlin, the status of the East German regime, and status quo in Europe as a whole, all of these things are linked together in these negotiations, part of a package. And there are objective linkages between these things as well. For example, this whole business of Berlin and a German nuclear capability. The Americans, when they're making the case to the West German government that they shouldn't go nuclear, their argument is, once you go nuclear, you lose the threat value, your ability to threaten that you will go nuclear if the other side does things you don't like put pressure on Berlin. So in order to maintain that threat value, in order to save West Berlin, you got to stay non-nuclear now. And the top official in the German Foreign Office that hears this argument from this American, he says, you know, I think you're right. And it kind of rubs his eyes. I haven't thought of that before. These issues are linked in all kinds of different ways, the Berlin business and the German nuclear question. And they try... working out a kind of general agreement that would provide for all of these things. But they can't quite bring themselves to do anything formal. And instead, a set of understandings emerges as a byproduct of these negotiations. And it's encapsulated in the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of July 1963. People think of arms control as somehow not related to the kind of core of international politics. This test ban treaty was about fundamental political issues, which you didn't want to deal with as such. You wanted to kind of muddy the waters a bit. The test ban treaty is like the top of the iceberg. It wasn't about arms control and the desire to end the arms race and do something that was in the interest of all humanity. The main interest of the Soviets in the test ban treaty was Germany. Those Americans signed, they would get the Germans to sign. Why was a German signature of the test ban treaty so important? Because if you can't test, you can't build. You need to be able to test in order to construct a nuclear arsenal. You get the Germans, well, more or less. You need the Germans to come on board as part of this whole set of understandings. And in the negotiations in Moscow that led to the signing of the test ban treaty, you have all of these broader issues being discussed and brought in so that below the surface, below what people can see, you know, a set of understandings comes into being symbolized by the test ban. That's the heart of it. There are other things that come into play as well. For example, the Americans come to think that maybe having Cuba as a communist state is not such a bad idea. Because it's a Soviet strategic dependency in our backyard, just the same way West Berlin is an American strategic dependency in their backyard. West Berlin is our Achilles heel. It's so easy for them to exert pressure on us there. Well, Cuba will say play the same role, and if they threaten West Berlin, we could threaten Cuba. The two things cancel each other out. You know, element in the structure makes for a more stable system. And it goes on. I don't have time to talk about this today, but the balance of payments aspect of the story also contributes to this whole thing. But the point is that by 1963, the rudiments of a stable system have come into being. This is a near settlement. Doesn't mean the Cold War is over, but the Cold War's character is transformed after 1963, because finally, after these three false starts, you now have one true start, which is the way the 1963 arrangements led to a political system that everyone could live with and to a relatively stable international political order for the balance of the Cold War. Okay, so let me end there. I'll begin this with 63 and try and deal with 63-75 next time.